ready. It's time to forge the narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge Narrative. My name is Paul Murphy, your host. We are the Bella Lost Souls podcast. This is episode 176. I'm joined today by Justin Troop and Adam Abramowitz.
What up, folk?
I now have the biggest arms of 40K.
On your side, Chris Morgan and Andrew Whitaker.
Hey guys.
What up, homies?
Man, it's been a cool week. It's been a kind of a light 40K week, unless you want to count some of these Eldar picks we kind of saw today. I don't think we were supposed to see those. They look like blurry pictures of the Sasquatch from the formations. We can kind of chat about that in a little bit.
That's a good parallel right there.
I've been burning the midnight oil working on a display board for Adepticon. Let me tell you, working with the GW kits are awesome. And you kind of think they're just all just going to go together because you see them in White Dwarf just kind of all just going together and looking awesome. It takes a lot more work. I have a lot of respect for those folks who put on those, build up those big old displays, because it takes some fiddling to get everything to line up right. And anyway, I'm glad I started early. That's all I can say.
Yeah, I've been working on a display board myself.
Let's just keep going talking about the awesome stuff we got coming out, because Gangs of Kamora. Do you guys see the write-up that I did on the Gangs of Kamora game on ForgeNarrative.net?
Yeah.
But give us a rundown, Paul.
Well, the neat thing about it is that those little terrain pieces that it comes with are actually supposed to represent the tops of the spires of the city. So above the smoke, above the smog, that's where these gangs are battling it out. And it really is. It's like one gang gets the drop on another gang, and that's how the game starts.
Does the board, like the board that it comes with, does it actually reflect that? Does it look like they're...
Well, it doesn't come with a board itself. You're supposed to play on at least a 3x3 area. And it's got those kind of like naval... You guys play Armada or any other kind of naval or flying game that has inertia kind of built into the game where you're...
Yeah, fleet-based.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You adjust your speed. It carries on right. In subsequent rounds of movement, that kind of thing.
It has some kind of effect built into it on that, where models have a minimum distance and a maximum distance that they can move, and then you can only turn certain degrees, certain radiuses, and then when you get how you determine who has initiative, like who goes first, how bad that you lost the role as the defender, you might not get to turn your models at all during the first part of the game. So, in facing matters. So, the bad guy could come, or the opponent could come up from behind you, and you're essentially, you know, in a bad spot for that first turn of the game before you start moving your pieces around.
Something about having a Dark Eldar come up behind me makes me very uncomfortable.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is supposed to mimic basically super, super high speeds, because these guys are zipping around on their bikes and the... I don't know what the things are called, the Hell Rider.
Everything's got to be mounted. So, yeah, then the reason for that is because you're flying up in the sky. But one of the neat things that we'll see maybe some expansions for in the future, I would guess, is that you build your gang a certain way. You build it with, you pick a rider, and there's different riders with different skills. You pick a mount for him to be on, a vehicle. So in this case, it's the jet bike, the Reaver jet bike, or the Hellion, you know, sky boat, whatever it is. And then you pick some weapons. And that's how you build them out. So those, and you can kind of imagine every figure line with those type of elements in it would fit pretty seamlessly into this game.
Seems pretty fun. I mean, if you're into the aesthetic, everyone's into the aesthetic, for being honest. It's a cool idea. Eldar, the Hellions, and all the rest of them. That's just a super fun idea that there's these like gangs of rapscallions jumping around up there and zooming around the spires. It's pretty cool. Very awesome.
There's, if you go the campaign route, there are things, you start taking breaks, essentially stick checks when you lose, I think, two-thirds or a third of your forces. Or you can just choose to break. Like, you know what? I don't like how this is going, so we're going to break. How you take out other people in this game is that you roll 2d6 and compare it to their agility score. So it's not just a straight one die to hit kind of thing. And then if you meet or beat their agility score, your weapon has a kill value. And then you roll the kill value, or try to roll the kill value on the 2d6. And if you meet or exceed it, then the enemy is, your target is dead.
So I'm just going to apologize if anybody on the internet has made this comparison already, but it kind of sounds like Quidditch with a little bit more ultraviolence involved.
I think that's spot on. That could be exactly what the inspiration
was. And you know what?
Blew my mind.
So then if you get the kill, but if you don't get the kill, then you get a wound counter, which reduces your agility and makes it easier for the weapon to kill. So every wound that you get makes it easier for the next weapon to come along and kill you. So that's what I was talking about. Maybe you just want to bug out. So your gang leader can say, we're getting out of here. We're too busted up, you know, and then that's fine. Because in the campaign side of it, there's you could play it a one-off game, like sitting down playing like Blood Bowl or something, like any of the Games Workshop one-off games. Or you can play it in a campaign style where you're getting money and you're building up your team or your gang. Because in a campaign style, you actually break your army up into different murder packs is what they're called. And then you roll randomly to see which murder pack actually takes place in the fight. And it's assumed at that point in time that your other murder packs are out there making money for you. So maybe you're just trying to contain these other guys over here while you're out there getting your income from other areas of your gang somewhere else in the city. So kind of a neat flavor, if you ask me.
A lot of bang for buck too. I mean, that's a very inexpensive box of stuff. You know, it comes with about 10 models, I believe, some of this stuff. And these rules sound very awesome. So yeah, I mean, sounds awesome to me. And I would be interested in playing it. Finding other like-minded individuals, I think, is the key.
Is there a name for the currency in Kimora?
I think it just refers to as income. I would also think it is called Dorchi Markies.
The old Deutsche Markies.
This set comes with tokens as well, but they're not cumbersome. Like, there's just enough to kind of give you the idea of what's going on, but you're not bogged down in a bunch of token management, which you can be in games sometimes.
X-Wing.
Yeah, it's a neat, if you already have the Dark Eldar figures, heck, if you even have Eldar figures or anything on a flying jet bike or skateboards or whatever, you could probably play this game as soon as you open the box. If you don't have to
play, why couldn't you play it with Jump Pack Marines or, you know?
Yeah, I don't see any reason why you couldn't. I honestly do not see any reason why you couldn't, especially if you use like the beginning, just the starter set. But there's no learning curve to the rules. The rules are very straightforward. Now it's like chess, though, in my opinion, where I could tell you what a pawn does. I can tell you how all the pieces move, but then it's up to you to play the game. That seemed to me kind of how this is.
Sweet, man. Yeah. Looking forward to seeing other people's coverage on it and seeing some games and stuff. I'll be looking at YouTube closely.
What models does it come with? Any?
The Hellions and Dark Eldar jet bikes.
Yeah.
Okay. It's pretty cool. And what's the count on them, like total number of models?
The game comes with 6 Dark Eldar Reavers and 10 Dark Eldar Hellions.
It seems like a pretty fair balance. I like that.
It's a solid cool. Two-player game, and it does come with 2 quick reference cards and like some of the weapons and stuff. Like most everything you need to know to play are on the quick reference cards. And it seems to me you'll pick it up within 20, 30 minutes and then can get right into the in-the-air throat-slitting.
Going back to what you were saying earlier, I mean, like, if you're an Eldar player, I don't see why you couldn't do this with Swooping Hawks and Wind Riders, you know, or even, you know, granted, Space Marine bikes don't fly, but what the heck? Maybe they're jet bikes.
For the purposes of this.
And jump packs. Yeah, you could do it.
Maybe we're going through the forest.
You just have, like, Samael by himself on his jet bike.
Or you have the 30K bikes, whatever those things are called.
Oh,
which are
the scimitar jet bikes.
Yes, they cost $1 million a model, which are awesome.
You know, I hated those models when I first saw them. You know, not to sidetrack.
When you see a couple of well painted really ones, like it changes your
yeah,
mind.
Yeah,
they're
really good.
So, guess where I'm going?
Honestly,
this is a fast paced game, and it says in the box, you know, breakneck combat. And so it's easy to kind of think it's just something they would say, but it actually does seem like it's going to play out really fast paced, where you can get several games in an afternoon after work or on an evening.
I mean, anytime that you can just break out a game and play it, I think that's one of the big appeals, for example, of like X-Wing or some of the other games that you could just kind of break out, play real quickly and put away. If you have a good buddy that or someone that you can play with routinely and you guys have an hour to kill, that's anytime you can pack the 40K universe into an hour, break it open, play it, put it away type board game. That's a win as far as I'm concerned.
That's a really good point, and I like the way you said that. Kind of get the whole 40K universe feel in a short amount of time.
And especially for like a dedicated Dark Eldar player who's maybe feeling a little down and out. There's been a couple that I know that have just enjoyed the opportunity to have something about them. You know, so if you got a Dark Eldar buddy, maybe offer to start a gang war with them. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, that's a good point, because they have not gotten a lot of positive attention recently.
When you're a shark, the sharks are the jets. Exactly.
It's funny that, you know, you said that, Chris, that in my mind, so the people that have received the least from Games Workshop over the past decade have been Chaos Space Marines, Dark Eldar, and of course, Sisters of Battle.
And Beltane.
And Well, come Bill, give me a break. All right, Paul, we're not even going to entertain that for a second. But let's look at in the past month what we've gotten for Chaos Space Marines, Dark Eldar, and Sisters of Battle. We've gotten if we're going to talk about St. Celestine, one of the most powerful single units in the game, in my opinion.
We are going to briefly talk about St. Celestine here for a minute. And
yeah,
I'm going with this is that the Ecclesiarchy relics. Now, we went over some of the more powerful ones in the last episode. And this original suggestion came in from a listener. Haven't replied to the email yet, but I'm going to. This is like the next best thing is hearing it here, though. But before we do that, I want to actually, you know, we talk all the time about supporting the folks that support us, and Powered Play is one of those. They came in big for Warzone Atlanta and want to do more. You'll see them at Adepticon and other places. You're going to see them at the LVO if you're coming up there. But I want to talk about something they're doing for our listeners. And they're offering a $15 coupon for purchases at their site. And I'm going to give the code out right now. So if you're driving, I apologize. I'll try to put this. I don't know if I can put it in the show notes or not, but I'll definitely. If you heard it and want to know what it was, you can message me on Facebook and we will get it to you. But the coupon code is PPGFTN15. That's PPGFTN15. As I understand it, if you enter in this coupon code, it will take $15 off your order. If you're getting a bunch of stuff, or you're getting one of their higher price kits, I think it's essentially going to take a little bit off that and get free shipping. So if you're looking to get into this, or you're looking to pick something else up for a project, get $15 off. And you know, that's it. They were great. They gave everybody at Warzone a gift card, and they even offered up some prizes. So I'm happy to continue to talk about these guys as we move forward. But I wanted to share that code with the listeners.
That's awesome.
So back on where I was going with the relics. So the Ecclesiarchal relics. These are we're going to talk about one of the ones we talked about. This is the Decival's Holy Circle. That's the one that the bearer of the Holy Circle has a 4+ invulnerable save. Furthermore, enemy units cannot arrive via deep strike anywhere within 12 inches of the bearer. If the enemy unit arriving via deep strike scatters within 12, they automatically suffer a deep strike mishap. So why are we talking about this again? Well, I see coming in from a listener is that he suggested that you take one of these formations of knights that allows you to upgrade a character to be able to take relics. But then if you have Celestine in the army, not in the detachment, or in an army that includes Celestine, then you get to take these relics. Then maybe that knight baron or warlord, whatever he's called, gets to take this holy relic for 35 points.
So we talked about this a little bit of a pre-show. It's an interesting concept, and I think this particular combo is going to be most useful in APOC-style games or 2,500 point or more games. And we'll talk about that in a second. But just as a threshold matter, this suggestion kind of opens the door to how you can combine these relics with all of the other armies of the Imperium via Celestine. Not necessarily knights, but you know, any of the other armies that can be represented in the Castellan book. Paul and I, and everyone on the show, has said multiple times that one of our big kind of repeated mantras is every time a new rule comes out or a new tool comes out, you have to go back and try and retrofit it to everything else. And that's where you can really find the hidden gems. And I think that this particular concept of taking these new relics and seeing where they best fit into old units is a really, really powerful one. And as it relates to this particular combo that was suggested, it really is it's flat out an anti-melta deterrent. So it really protects those knights. And two, it gives them a 4+ invulnerable save in close combat.
I think that's the biggest part here. I mean, but the two things that you mentioned, because one of the ways you kill knights is causing like some shield confusion. You know, you drop two meltas on the front, two meltas on the back. What do they do? Kind of thing. This takes that away. And then you're able to get that 4+ invulnerable in close combat.
Now that can make or break it with a knight is the close combat, because that's at the same time as it can be extremely useful to have a knight in close combat if you're fighting something that can't hurt you. But if you're fighting something like a Wraith Knight that swings first and you have a chance to block some of those D hits that, you know, as long as it's not the six, of course, that can make a big difference between you getting the swing and you not getting the swing.
Yeah, and especially even with people, I think the Wraith Knight's a great example, right? It's 25 points of insurance, because a lot of times players play with shooting Wraith Knights that don't... 35 points, I'm sorry, yeah. But a lot of times players play with the shooty Wraith Knights, which are actually still very, very lethal, even in close combat against Imperial Knights, because they're strength 10. So they don't even necessarily need D weapons.
At I-5.
They glance at I-5. They glance on threes, pen on four up with a base AP of two. They can penetrate and blow up knights before they swing, even without the D weapon. If you finally get into combat, having lost a couple of hull points, a Wraith Knight will probably kill an Imperial Knight at I-5. Not so if that Imperial Knight, not guaranteed, or much less likely if that Imperial Knight is wielding a 4+ invulnerable save.
Now, I can't roll a 4+, so I don't know what that's going to feel like. I just assume that half the time, that's going to be really nice for someone.
I think that your math checks out.
But going back and looking at how these relics do apply, as Andrew was talking about, to all the other things, we're not going to find the best combo, I don't think, coming out just yet. But that, I think that's still a pretty impressive one, provided that you're able to work it that way. And the only reason I'm saying provided is because that the heirlooms, I went, and after I did this, I started looking at the way the relics are worded in every other book. Sometimes they're called relics. Sometimes the section has a different name. And then it goes on to say these are relics, whatever. I would then say that anything in that section is a relic and would classify into anything that affects a relic. So if we get a war gear out there later that says destroys a relic.
When it comes to Tau, like a signature system?
Yes, exactly. Because there are plenty of rules that specifically refer to a relic or your codex's equivalent thereof. And I think signature systems, knight heirlooms, chaos, icons,
I think anyone that's trying to make
whatever.
Too much of an argument about, oh, it's not a relic, it's a signature system. It's just like, all right, dude.
Well, this is a bit of a world that we live in right now. And sometimes those words matter. Like, sometimes it's going to be really that ironclad and it's going to matter. In this case, though, I don't think it does. I think it is just anything in this section with this heading and this alternate colored page is a relic. So I want to put three knights, Celestine and Kodiaz, and I don't know, a couple of veteran squads.
You won't even fit the veteran squads. With a couple of knights in Saint and Kodiaz.
The cheapest knight formation in which you can unlock a knight that has the capacity to take heirlooms is three knights. Isn't that correct?
It is. And it's like it's 1,100 or something points.
That's what I'm saying. You can shoehorn it in. It's 1,100 points for the three knights. Celestine bumps you up to about 1,400 or so, right? Isn't she like 2.25 or something?
She's
like 200 that?
Points. But let's just assume that we're a little under on the knights. So
okay, perfect. So we'll call it 1,300 for those four models, which is just wild to say out loud. And then Kodiaz bumps you up to 1,400, and then you've got another 450 points to put in guardsmen or whatever else you need.
Yeah, so it's there. That's four or five units a drop, scions.
Sure, or you can just spam platoon guys. If you really just want cheap scoring, 50-point platoon guys that come back on a 5+, I don't hate it.
I wanted some guys that would just be able to come in, drop, pump, dump their stuff, get killed, maybe come back. That's why I thought five dudes with two melted guns might be the way to go.
Andrew says he doesn't hate it. I don't hate it, and here's why. You're tooling yourself up and you're preventing the deep strike or the drop pod list. How many of those are winning LVO? How many of those are winning Warzone Atlanta?
The question is actually different than that. The question is, what's preventing Knights from winning war games? And Melta coming in, drop Melta, or getting close with Melta is something that's preventing Knights from being more competitive.
You know what?
Everyone can kill Knights right now. There are things that kill Knights, and that's why Knights are not doing better. This is something that allows Knights to do better. This is not the flu shot that inoculates Knights from ever being destroyed. It is something that is much better. The 4+ invulnerable all around, where you can't circumvent it, can't get behind them. The ability to
I agree with that 100%.
The ability to not be able to drop in things close to them and get additional damage to them with quality AP1 or whatever hits.
Yeah,
the 4+ invulnerable only works on one knight, correct?
Right, but it also prevents the drop, right? So if you deploy that knight properly, you can protect one or both other knights from getting deep struck on. And that's, I think, for a turn, but that's it. That's the crux of it. I mean,
that's all you need a lot of times.
It's not necessarily all you need, but one turn of additional guaranteed survival is a huge thing for a knight player. Trust me, I play knights. It is massive when I can say, if I can deploy on the table against a guy with a drop pod Gladius, and know that on turn one, and he's got first turn, I can deploy these knights and be confident that at least two of them, probably three, are secure from getting melted dropped. That's a huge, huge advantage. And Kodiaz really helps to protect the other knight between the null drop zone relic knight and Kodiaz ensuring that I've been expecting you rule. I can have this huge near 24-inch or even bigger than that. It's like a 36-inch no deep strike bubble because nobody wants to land and then get shot in the face by whatever unit has joined Kodiaz.
Some plasma cannon totem jumps or something.
Whatever it is. So I got to interrupt, not purely for my role on the show being the guy that asks stupid questions and is counter to everything that you guys say. And I think the listeners know that's why I'm here, right? To argue.
The first part, for sure.
Yeah, the first part for sure. So I'm not just saying this to argue, but what you guys are saying is absolutely 100% correct. But where are you scoring objectives? How are you winning the game with all the dudes?
The other 400 points, right? So my iteration of that list, right? I have 400 points of troops. And Paul said he would take some Scion guys. Okay, that's cool. It's a good option. 400 points of Scions comes in about, I don't know, 6 squads. They're 75 points a pop. Depending on the upgrades, he could probably get 5-6 squads of Obsec Scions. That's a good option. My version would have something like 300 points of just platoon guardsmen. 300 points is what? Is that 6 squads at 50 points a piece plus another 100 points of upgrades?
You could combine them together and where it mattered and split them up where it didn't matter. I mean, that's
right. So both of our proposed versions have at least 6 OBSEC troop choices, potentially more. Mine could go up to 8 or 9, depending on how I want to skin the okay. upgrade cap.
I can reason with that. I needed to hear it. But yeah, okay, I get it.
Yeah, absolutely. And absolutely. I'm not saying run out there and do that right now. I'm saying that if you have knights and your knights are, and this is some of the things preventing your knights from doing better and more competitive events, this is something to look at and see how it affects. Because I think it's pretty strong if your plan is to run knights anyway.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
It definitely will affect the survivability of them, especially if you're in those kind of environments where you see a lot of that deep strike melta. On a personal level, it feels very like a very defensive way to play, but sometimes that's what you need to do. It may not be my particular style, but I can't argue with the idea that that going up against a knight that's effectively bubble wrapped in several layers with an army that I usually like to play, which is very alpha strikey or beta strikey, it gets a little bit tougher.
Every turn that knight is alive, he becomes more and more valuable and harder to kill. Bar none.
Because he's picking up the stuff that you have that can kill him.
Yeah, the thing that you failed to kill him with, he's now charged and murdered and or whatever. So anyway, that's a neat thing. This part of the show, we're actually going to do the finishing moves right now, and then I'm going to do another segment after this one. And by the way, I had a lot of good response about the kind of making a game, how would you get into the game industry segment. I'm going to continue that. I actually lined up Benson again and someone else when I probably are going to record that next week. So I might have like a 2-for shot from those guys on that topic. I'm going to try to line up another player spotlight coming up pretty soon. I'm going to have an episode talking about nothing but dice math. Are you guys excited about that?
Nerd.
Yeah.
The amount of attention we put on those 6-sided little buggers.
Yeah. It's the next thing I want to talk about is finishing moves. We have a new sponsor for finishing moves this time. This time it's going to be Frontline Gaming. And Frontline, of course, they have a lot of stuff going on. LVO is coming up in a couple of weeks. Chris, I think you have something quickly you want to mention about that.
That's right. Just wanted to put it out there. All of the judges are accepting questions for the LVO. Anything that isn't covered by the GW Basic Rulebook FAQ. So the Codex FAQs that just came out are not being used at the LVO because it was after the cutoff. But anything in the Basic Rulebook that we haven't covered yet, if you have questions about it, put it on the Las Vegas Open Facebook page. There is a pinned post that has a picture of Judge Dredd, says, "I am the law." Ask your rules questions there, and we will get them answered.
It's going to be a mega huge event, and Frontline has a bunch of goodies coming out soon. I don't know if everything's up for display yet, but we'll certainly be talking about them as we go through their sponsorship for our hobby segment. The Finishing Moves segment for this show is going to be about stencils. Stencils, and we'll get to decals later, but stencils for sure this week. And this is real tricky. Because I know that I struggle with this largely because I have a lack of discipline And I'll tell you why. And I don't want no spoilers, but it's I get impatient. I mess up my stencil work.
You know, to address that right off the bat, stencils seem at the forefront as an easy approach to making something look really cool. But it's actually a very time intensive technique.
Yeah, you think, what's the problem here? Well, I'm just going to pull it out of the pack. I'm going to stick it on my model. I'm going to hold it with my hand, my thumb, and my forefinger, and I'm just going to spray.
And shoot, and win a golden demon.
It's not that easy. And that's, you know, like similar to Paul's approach to using an airbrush where you never have to clean it out. You actually have to take
low
some,
blow.
That it was Andrew who never cleans his airbrush.
I think we might have some audio evidence.
Whatever, dude.
Sick burn, bro.
I'm a dirty guy.
Somebody got burned. I don't know who it is. But.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does, and you know what? It is very tedious, and it seems very boring at the onset of it. But if you take your time to it and you apply decals right or stencils correctly, it can pay off.
I have something to interject real quick. It's the tools that can make the stenciling a lot easier. So depending on this type of stencil that you're using is going to dictate the type of tools that are required. Because I think that's something that a lot of people don't think about when they grab stencils. You know, we just get our meat paws on them, we slap them over there, and we're not thinking. But there are tools of the trade.
You know, there are, and there really are. Yeah. Like Tamiya tape and that expensive like frog tape and blue tape that you can get from Home Depot. That stuff is designed to work with paint, but it's still, if you're not patient, you're going to pull a big slab of paint off your model.
So I would invest, if you're going to make your own stencils and you're doing your own custom camo, invest in Tamiya tape. It's the yellow tape that you see. You can buy it in different widths. It is, bar none, the best for hobby painting that you can ever apply. Before we get into like too much of using stencils, whatever you do, please, and I beg of you, please, if you're using an airbrush, and you should be if you're using a stencil, apply a sealer on top of your layer that your base layer.
This is where we're talking about. Step one is going to be finish the area. You've got your model done. You got your model where you think it's going to be. You love it. You like the look of it already. All right. And then seal it. And then dry. Like let the seal completely cure. I mean, I'm talking about like I live in Georgia. It's humid here. Walk away for 3 days. Maybe 24 hours is enough, but 3 days to be sure.
Yeah. I think most sealants flash in 24 hours. Yeah.
But I don't want anybody to say I did 24 hours and I pulled a piece of my model up. Yep. You should have waited 25 or 3 days.
It's all very dependent on how, if you're gonna just apply your sealant in one heavy coat, wait 3 days. If you're gonna apply it in three light coats, wait 24 hours and move on to something else in your project.
Paul's your absolutely stencil,
right there.
And the stencil may not come in a bit like you're not looking at a notebook paper, you know, with this tiny little stencil in it. You might be looking at a small, might be the size of a stamp. Could be the size of a playing card or whatever, just to have the actual design on there. When you put it down, tape with the nice tape, with the good tape we're talking about, and this is it could even be masking tape from the grocery store, but it can't be like, certainly can't be like duct tape, or I wouldn't even try gaffer's tape. You want it to be specifically masking tape.
I would stick to like Gorilla Tape makes a good painter's tape. I think it's the green version.
Yeah, stick to a painter's tape or masking tape, specifically masking tape.
Yeah, if low you want adhesive. To be sure, if you exactly, thank you, Justin, for saying that. If you want to be sure, just invest the extra 58 cents or whatever it is in the Tamiya tape.
The Tamiya tape, I think it's a little bit more expensive than that. But it does exactly what you want it to do. So that in itself is its own values, that it does what you want it to do. But when you have your design and when you put it where you want it to go, tape it down with just enough tape to keep it steady, but also tape way around where you plan on spraying to prevent any kind of overspray getting anywhere else on your model.
Here's another piece about tools that I want to talk about too. Clay shapers with the rubber tips. That's what I use to manipulate my tape. And on top of that, for the first time you're ever going to hear me say this, change the blade on your X-Acto knife. Yep. You want a good sharp tip on that bad boy.
Yep.
And just, you know, wrap something around your fingers because you're going to cut yourself with that.
That's why I never change my blade.
So There's a few companies out there that actually make pre-cut stencils for you to use. And I've toyed around with several of them. And I think one of the reasons that I won my first ever Best Painted contest was because of the stencils that I used that were purely 3M blue masking tape that I made my own cuts with. But I decided to try a couple other different stencils out there. And I had a lot of problems with some of them that are on the market today. But I fell upon, and I'm saying this and I want our listeners to know that the company I'm about to mention didn't provide us any advertising supports. This is purely a personal recommendation. The guys at Fallout Hobbies make fantastic stencils. They're painters themselves, they're hobbyists themselves, and their stencils are really good. They're reusable if you treat them well and maintain them. I was able to do an entire about 2,250 points worth of Eldar vehicles, a Wraith Knight, and something like 30 jet bikes with their stencils. And they've got a bunch of different options to choose from. I would highly recommend checking them out. They're very high quality, perfect for what we do kind of stencils.
Well, they're designed specifically with the right size. You know, they're all 28 millimeter or whatever. So that's a really good tip. Even if you don't go with them, which I do suggest, by the way, I just got some decals from Fallout Abbeys for my Black Templar drop pods. But they're designed specifically for what we do. So, you know, that matters sometimes. And when you were talking about Eldar and stuff, things that have these patterns on them that you know you're going to use or on more than one figure that you don't possibly even want to be freehanding on, get a stencil for it. And that could be even the diamond pattern on Harlequin vehicles. It could be for certain on Eldar vehicles. It could be for a specific type of, kind of camo. And I don't mean like the jungle, the woodland camo we're talking about, but I mean like that techno camo for vehicles. Or just any manner of thing like that. Get a stencil for it and find a good one. But it starts, do not forget this, seal it and then walk away for a while. And then you can come back and start the seal or start the stencil. I think that's the number one tip this is what I am most guilty of, is not waiting long enough before I start. Because once you peel a piece of paint off with the tape, there's no fixing that.
It's ruined, yeah.
You cannot layer paint back up to look anywhere realistic in that divot.
It's the hobby equivalent of playing taps. Just the music starts and you just feel sad and you salute and then you get out your simple green.
Yeah, I mean or just hope no one notices, or you put a real decal over it or whatever. Maybe that's just how, you know.
No, dude, it's chipping. It's chipping, yeah, dude.
You weather it.
And make sure
it's weather.
And along the same lines, like after you wait for one day or 3 days, whatever it is, like go back with that rubber shaper that Justin was talking about, just to make sure everything's still adhered before you get ready with that airbrush. It's just make sure that you're not missing anything, because especially, and usually you're not using stencils if you're not using an airbrush. So you're using an airbrush, it will pick up that tape unless it's appropriately adhered. So make sure everything's tight, or else you're going to get some very loose stencils on there.
When you spray, you don't want to get in there heavy hand. And you're right, you should be using an airbrush for this, or heck, even sometimes a spray can, a rattle can would even work. I've done that before. I'm not embarrassed. It turned out really well.
Yeah, I've done a rattle can before.
You don't want to go too crazy with it, because if you start to soak into your tape or whatever, then there you have the possibility of getting some of the top paint bleed over into the model itself. You don't want to do that either. There is some technique in here, and you can be heavy handed with the sealer, the gloss, the varnish, the satin, or whatever it is that you use. Let it dry real good. People put their tape, I've seen them put tape on. Like I watch tutorials.
I would highly recommend a satin or a matte.
Yeah, I see people pulling the tape off their models like the tape has been on there for days. Like, oh, could have never done that. I could have never pulled that off the way that way without ripping paint up. But they do it. So I suggest make sure the tape is adhered properly where you put it, but is the least amount necessary. But then make sure you've covered up a bunch of your overspray area. And this is, you can use tape for that, like the big patches of blue tape. But you don't have to actually stick it to the model. You can create like a, I don't know, some kind of stop gap in between where you actually have it adhered to the model and then, you know, another layer over it that's not adhered to the model.
Rubber gloves work pretty good for that.
Rubber gloves are great. You know, Justin, thanks for pointing that out. You know, you can buy a box of nitrile gloves from you know, Walmart or CVS for
$1.99. You cellophane, just like he was doing power swords on some Grey Knights.
You can, yeah.
And he just stuck the swords to the
cellophane's great. And this is my next tip is invest in some blue tack. And for those of you that don't remember what blue tack is or don't know, when you were in grade school and your teacher used to tell you to take down like the Christmas decorations or whatever, what she had them up with, if it wasn't tape, was that little blue tack. And you can buy that at you know,
you can get it at the drugstore.
Staples, you can get it at the drugstore, you can get it anywhere. But that's another great way to like, if you're doing it on a small model, or you've got a really finicky area where you can't get the tape to it here, just throw some blue tack over top of that and it's perfect. And you can even use a blue tack if you're doing camouflage. You can use it.
Well, that's masking. That's a little bit, it's a little bit different, but it's same vein. I'm with you. But different.
Yeah, it is, but it isn't. If you're thinking about doing like Imperial Guard camouflage, blue tack works perfectly for that.
We'll talk about that as a future topic too, because there's all kind of the medium clay, all kind of stuff you can use for that stuff. So that'd be, I think, almost a topic on its own. But I mean, stencils are big now because we're getting a lot of beautiful vehicles. They've got some wide open panels, you know, waiting for something to happen to them, waiting for some amazing painter to come by and do something to them. But you could do it, you know, on the easy with some stencils. And another point on stencils, when I was talking about freehand designs you didn't want to do, if you had a stencil for like the larger design, maybe your larger design is a dragon or something, and you could just stencil on the body of the dragon and then go in and hand paint some stuff. You could hand paint over where you did your stencil, and that's another 5 or so minutes or more, depending on the size of it, that you could put into your model that would really take it past that just like, oh, you used a stencil to put that on. Of course it was easy. No, you've just blown their minds with your painting on top of your stencil technique.
I waited 3 days for this stencil jerk.
We've gotten a lot of like really crazy flying monstrous creature type models, you know, Tyranids, demons. Magnus, not so much, but like if you're looking at like the new Bloodthirster sculpt from about a year ago, I mean, Fallout Hobbies, again, makes it great. They make reptile skin hobbies. That's what I use on my Eldar. You know, throw that over top of the wings and, you know, give it just one coat of a different color, whatever it is, or just a lighter shade of the color that you used. Really make them pop before you go back in and work in the details. I mean, trust me, this stuff.
And you're talking about a subtle. You're talking about you've got, and this, but it's still, subtle, it's at the end there where you've actually, you know, you've done your model and you've gone in with not a full, you're not blasting, it's not hard lines. You've put a fade of this stencil on a model. And it
even just to kind of build up off of last week's topic of doing camo, stencils are another way that you can accomplish that. There's a lot of applications for stencils beyond just unique designs using tape or stuff that you can buy. There's really a lot of good options out there, and it's going to be a lot easier than trying to paint it all by hand.
This is the last thing that I'll throw in here, then we can wrap up. And then again, there'll be a segment coming after this one. So hold in there. Is that if you're not getting something like specific to a gaming, like you're not looking for something out there that's 40K-ish, you can go to other sites and get things like biohazard symbols and, I don't know, stuff that works great for orcs. And you're not paying a hobby price for it. You're paying, you know, whatever the common man, the generic price for these stencils, and they work just the same.
That's actually a good point about... There's a lot of, especially when it comes to painting more so obviously than the actual models themselves, but Michael's Craft Store or whatever, you know, if you have a Hobby Lobby or the otherwise, those hobby supplies are usually wildly cheaper than what we pay for 40K centric or even, you know, name your generic hobby centric painting and modeling equipment. But what Paul just hit the nail on the head, you can find stencils for all sorts of stuff that can be kind of extrapolated out and used in the 40K world at way cheaper than if you go to these kind of hobby-centric suppliers, if that makes sense. There's stuff that's just made for the masses is going to be a lot less expensive and oftentimes can be put to good use.
So check if you're doing terrain, you know, like if you're – like I've got some Coke cans that I've turned into chemical plants, you know, like anybody else would or whatever. And I put biohazard symbols on them and I got the biohazard stencil for, I don't know, 50 cents somewhere.
Anyway. I mean, they don't come like that?
Anyway, guys, I know it's been a short segment with you guys recording here, so I appreciate y'all coming in here and hanging in with me for tonight. Anything you want to toss in on the stencil topic or anything else we talked about? Knight relics, protecting your knights, I'm going to take that as a no.
I guess we'll just say good night then.
Play the Adlance. If you really want to keep your night safe, play the Adlance.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey everybody, we are back. I've got Horton Doughton with us.
Hey, how you doing?
Horton, you don't know this, but we just did the main show, or the regular show, and now we're with you, coming in and bringing us home to talk about the subject that everyone likes, magnets.
Oh, okay, magnets.
Or fun with flags.
Fun with, well, great, yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. I use magnets on models.
Everybody likes flags, right?
Yeah, flags are good. But tough to freehand.
Yeah, what I actually have you here for, though, is to talk about, it's a term, I mean, essentially effective casting dice. Like when there are things that modify what you cast on, what does your effective casting dice pool actually look like? And then what does that mean? Like how many dice should you be throwing at any given power?
Well, this is an important topic because I think it's very easy to misjudge the odds when you're trying to think about how many dice you should throw at a psychic power. So there's some equations you can do, which we won't get into. I'll just tell you the numbers that you can calculate all this stuff. And it's a good idea to have these in the back of your mind when you go to cast a psychic power, in my opinion.
So everyone knows, of course, I mean, they probably wouldn't be with us right now if they didn't know how you generated psychic dice. But that roll, you know, it could be a big multiplier. Like if you're rocking one or two librarians or sorcerers and, you know, a combined total of four psychic dice and you roll a six, that's a big impact on maybe what you were planning to do that phase.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, if you have 10 dice, suddenly you have a lot more dice to cast with. But it's an important decision to make when you see you have 10 dice to basically decide, okay, how many powers am I going to attempt to cast? Right. Maybe I have two librarians and I could cast four powers, but what are my odds of success in doing that? Is that a good idea? What is the highest priority right now?
Now, you're an accomplished player, so I want to talk about first the facts and the specifics, and then maybe if we get the opportunity to talk about that, because there is a little bit of a psych out game here in the psychic phase that keys into this too, I think.
Well, there is. Because of depending on how many dice your opponent has and their ability to deny the witch, it really is a little mini game you can do if you both have a lot of dice. It can be interesting. If your opponent, let's say you have 20 dice and your opponent has 20 dice, you really have to think it through, especially if you have witchfire power you're trying to cast.
Yeah, so the nitty gritty of this is, again, the effective psychic dice. So let's take you've got a seer council casting on threes, harnessing, you know, warp charge on threes. That changes, that's a factor in changing on what you can actually do. Like it turns your dice pool, you're automatically almost, you know, the rough number is almost 70%, 17% more effective than you are a normal person casting on fours.
Yes, it is. And that compounds as you throw more dice at the same power. But I think it's important to understand the base math behind simply harnessing on a 4+, and we can see how that is modified by increased casting numbers and then also how many dice you're throwing at a given psychic power.
So give me your take on that.
Not to go on too long about this, but if you're attempting to cast a level 1 power, casting on a 4+, as most all psychers do, and you only throw one dice at it, then you only have a 50% chance of success. All right, that's not too complicated. Okay, however, essentially, as you go up in the number of dice you throw at a level 1 power, you essentially approach 100% in a curve that keeps getting there by half, but can never mathematically reach 100. So what I mean is, again, a level 1 power, one dice, 50% odds of success. Two dice, 75. Three dice, 87.5. Four dice, 93.8.
Wait, it wasn't 100%? Because that's when I was hoping we'd get to 100.
Well, you can, if you get to 99.9 when you go to 10 dice, but it's very hard to guarantee anything with dice.
So we're not talking about that you get lucky, you know, it's a warp charge two, you throw two dice, you got the power off. It's a great day for you. We're talking about just mathematically what you should be doing and know when you're taking a risk. This is to inform people of when they're taking a risk.
Yes, this whole conversation is about making informed decisions. If you want to gamble, that's great. But when I think about casting psychic powers ever since the whole new 7th edition system came out, I like things to be reliable. So back in the day, I ran a list that had about 19 dice, and I would divide my dice pool in half, and I would throw 10 at the summoning and then 9 at the summoning because I just want to make sure that happens. But even then, with 9 dice at a level 3 power, my odds of success are only 91% if I'm casting on 4s. And even with 10 dice, it's only 94.5. You know, you think, oh, that's really high, but in the course of a 6 or 7 turn game, you will fail one of those.
Well,
you
have a decent chance. The idea, though, you have a warp charge 3 power. You want to get it off. You think that I need 4 pluses. Let me throw 6 dice. What is 6 dice, the odds on that, on getting a level 3 off?
Sure, that's a great question. So if you throw 6 dice at a level 3 power casting on 4s, your odds of success are 65.6%.
That sounds... I mean, I know it's above 50, but that does not sound near as reliable, I think, as a lot of people think it might have been.
No, that's kind of like passing a 3-up armor save, if you think about it that way. Yeah, you have times when it'll work, but you have plenty of times where you roll that 1 or a 2 and it doesn't go off, right? For the 3-plus armor save comparison. So, you know, how crucial is that level 3 power? Do you really need it to go off? Is it as reliable as power armor to you? You know, so you really have to think, do I want to throw more dice at that?
Well, not to slant the conversation, though. The warp charge, the higher the warp charge, the higher the impact the power typically has on the game. I think the game has done a pretty good job of scaling that to some degree, even with the newer powers. Like, some of them are warp charge 2 that you might not have expected to be, I guess, but they are. With those level 2 and 3 powers, I think it behooves you to want to get them off. And so this happens also in like building your list. So if you're banking on getting one of these powers, you think it's going to really help you in the game, you want to make sure that you've got at least the baseline number of dice to be able to effectively cast it.
Yes, especially these big powers, right? The summoning is a great example. If you're casting the summoning, it's usually because you really need the summoning. So you can't afford for it to fail, so don't mess around. You know, throw all your dice at it if it really has to happen.
Like, for instance, if you're fighting, you're building an army that is low on being able to punch through armor, through the vehicles or whatever, you think, well, I'll just summon up some of these demons or those demons to be able to do that. Or I'm always going to bank on getting invisibility or something like that to win my games and doing out of tough matchups. There's more to it than just hoping you roll that number.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, that you've really got to think through how many dice it's going to take. Now, a Librarius Conclave changes this math entirely because you get to harnessing on a 2+.
Well, let's bring us back into the effective dice. You know, we're talking about just how to cast normal powers, like what you should be rolling to be able to get in there and cast that power that you want to cast, the level 2s, the level 3s. You know, I think that we can all pretty much agree that if you throw two or three dice, which everyone should have if you're a psyker, at a level 1 power, you're probably just fine. It's those level 2s and 3s that I think that people might kind of struggle with conceptually and may have, and maybe based on some of the real evidence that they've seen in their previous game, have kind of a misrepresentation in their mind about what they should be rolling, how many dice they should be rolling.
That's a good point. For me, I recently started playing an army that has a lot of psykers in it. And when I think about casting a power, I think I really wanted this to happen. So I think about the number of dice to throw at something. What are my odds of success? How many dice do I need to throw to have about an 85% or higher odds of success? You know, that's pretty good. I'm willing to gamble that 15%. Okay, so how that breaks down for levels 1, 2, and 3 powers is, assuming no reroll right now, that changes the math a little bit.
And we're talking about just a 4, you're needing a 4 plus right now.
Yes, just needing a 4. That would mean to get 85% or higher odds of success at a level 1 power, you would need to throw 3 dice at it. At a level 2 power, you would need 6 dice. And at a level 3 power, you would need 8 dice. That's if you don't want to mess around and you want to play the odds of 85% or higher odds of success.
And this is not a spell. This is not factoring a spell familiar or Tigerius rerolling failures or anything like that. This is just base level whatever psyker casting a power.
Yes.
Okay. So now let's take that up to the armies that have the ability to cast on threes.
Sure. So that basically, like you mentioned earlier, that increases your odds by an additional roughly 17%. Okay. Which compounds as you throw multiple dice at it. Again, if you're looking at that 88% threshold, okay, or excuse me, 85% threshold.
I like 88. 88 is better for me. I'm still not going to cast the power right when I need it, but.
Well, 88 is better for sure.
We can go with 81. Well, let's not skew. Let's just say that 15% chance of failure is something we're fine with.
If you're gunning for that 15% chance of failure, okay, then you're looking at only two dice for a level one. Okay, four dice for a level two, and six dice for a level three. Your odds are actually a bit higher with six and three, with the level three and a level two. But that's the next step above 85.
That sounds pretty good. I mean, you've shaved off two dice off that top end.
You really do. It really makes a big difference.
Two whole dice. I mean, that could be all the communal pool that you roll. That's a whole level of contributing psykers, which maybe you didn't need to worry about.
Yeah, it could be an additional level one power casting on threes.
Okay. So I know in three, casting on threes is more common. We see that now. And then you mentioned the Conclave casting on twos. What does that take us to?
Yes, the Conclave and our good friend Magnus can cast on twos. So if you're looking at to get, again, 85% success or higher, then you're looking at two dice at a level one. It's actually 97% with two dice.
Well, what is one die?
One die is 83.3.
So you're just right under the threshold. But still, you could cavalry.
Extremely reliable. At that point, it costs you so little. Why not try it? So for the level one powers, you're looking at one dice to give you 83.3% chance of success. For a level two power, three dice gives you a 92% chance. For a level three power, four dice to reliably get it off. And then in the case of being Magnus, then if your level four power is above that threshold with six, and a level five power is above that threshold at seven.
Seven dice. You know, I mean, that math sounds a little bit daunting when you're thinking that a lot of armies don't come to the table with too many levels of psykers. You either have to commit to the psychic phase, and which of course armies that are there to cast psychic powers do, you know, or you've got to focus on one or two powers that turn that you want off.
Well, I'd say there are probably two mentalities about that. You can either say, I'll focus on trying to get off these three powers, or I have a bunch of little psychers who on their own aren't that good, but I'll just take 50% odds on like 10 powers and see what happens. So either approach can be effective, but I think more often than not, those critical power, getting off those critical powers is the better play.
Well, this math is a little bit easier to do, but let's talk about, do you have the things worked out for perils?
No, but your odds of perils go up the more dice you throw.
Well, I mean, obviously, right. But I just use simple math at that point in time. Like every six dice that I roll, one of them is going to be a six. And there's a probability that's not too far out of the realm of reason that I could get double six. So if I'm rolling six dice or more, then I have a higher degree of perilsing. So there is that also.
Yeah, I actually don't have that mapped out, but that is something you have to keep in the back of your mind, especially if you have a psyker that is also a flying monstrous creature who can ground himself, or someone on the ground who doesn't have that many wounds.
Well, sometimes you gotta risk it anyway. Like, oh, you know what? I need this power to go off. I've got to throw 14 dice at it.
And you do.
Things are just going to fall where they may.
You do. And perils is less risky now than it was in previous editions, because if you roll that five or six, then you don't take any damage. On the perils chart is what I mean.
Yeah, I'm with you. Okay. I like how you laid it out there. It's kind of odd to me. Now, I do things, just a lot of things by instinct, you know, and then banking on the 50% odds of a 4+ or whatever. But you have kind of defined that of just how many dice you save even getting that casting on a 3+. And then if you've got things like spell familiars or whatever on the chaos side, I mean, the odds seem to be really in your favor of getting powers off.
Yeah, that's what spell familiar is what really makes chaos psykers so good. Eldar to some extent, because they can reroll some of their failed dice as well. But just sticking with chaos for now, the ability to reroll this totally improves the math dramatically. right? You know, you're talking about one dice at a level one power with the spell familiar, your odds of success go from 50 to 75, right? It's like having double the dice.
Yeah, then you're really only limited by your mastery level.
Oh, yeah. You're just really limited by the mastery. And similarly for a level, if you harness on a three and you have a spell familiar, then, you know, you're looking at odds of success at about 89%. That's really high. That's actually higher than Magnus or a Librarius Conclave. So there are a handful of chaos formations where you get that modified cast on a three. And that is where you can really start casting unbelievable amounts of powers.
Well, I think that, and what I'm trying to illustrate here, not maybe not specifically with the spell familiar, but the power that we're talking about, the rerolls and the Farseer, I mean, it's built into the cost. I don't want to say it's free. It's part of their rules. Things like Tigerius, things like the Conclave, things like the Cabal that give you extra dice to cast their special power. And demons, of course, with their factory of warp dice that they can generate. It's like the rich get richer. So if you are wanting to compete in the psychic phase, you can do it with almost a minimal investment.
Oh yeah, yeah, you can. Those particular armies, if you understand how to it's just dice management at that point. And the same thing works for Deny the Witch, right? Like you got to manage and play your odds there in terms of, well, I don't have a shot at even denying that one, so I'll save my dice for when he gets that one success power off.
Can we talk about the mind games yet?
Yeah, yeah, I love mind games.
Well, you mentioned you brought it up with Deny the Witch, of course, because your dice pool that you have for your psychers, of course, generates the Deny the Witch or your psychic pool for the denial phase, but it's a lot harder. So denying powers is, I mean, it sometimes just seems like, why am I even bothered? Why am I even, you just let me know what you cast, I'll come back. This is when I'm going to go grab a beer, hit the restroom. You just let me know what's up.
Yeah, if they're casting a lot of blessings, then it really does feel like that sometimes, especially if you yourself are not playing a psychic heavy army, then it's like, oh, I mean, they just have their turn and I can't really stop it. I have three dice and they have 20. I'm out of luck here. But even then, you know, there's certain units that if they're targeted, but even certain Tau units, right, that are, if they're targeted by an enemy psyker, then they get modifiers to Deny the Witch. And then even a handful of dice, you have a decent shot at stopping that power, depending on how many successes your opponent got.
I think so, we can do the math on needing sixes, like how many sixes, how many dice do we need to roll to get two sixes or whatever. But what about when you do have that adamantium will, needing it on a five?
Yeah, well, you know, it cuts it in half. So you become twice as good at denying the witch. So it's like making your three dice six dice or something like that.
The reason I bring this up, because sometimes I think that it benefits you to either pack a psyker, even if it's a level one or level two in your army, just to have a couple of extra dice for this to maybe matter. If you know, you think in your area you're going to be fighting this kind of stuff.
Yes. This is one particular case where Gene Steel Occult really come to mind, where their Magus is a psyker, but he also has adamantium will. So even if he is your only psyker at level two, his unit will be denying on a 4+. And so even just a handful of dice can very reliably protect him and his unit from any incoming enemy psychic attack.
And you still may wilt under the weight of psychic dice from the opponent, but they're not always trying to just zap you. They're trying to do some stuff to themselves or whatever, and then they want to hit you with something, a psychic shriek or some kind of malediction or something along those, hallucination or something. They're trying to do something to you depending on what they roll, and maybe you just want to make sure that this one business unit can get in there, not be hampered by that.
Well, and that's where the mind games start. Right. Like if you've got your one unit with a psyker in it and just a handful of dice, but your opponent is casting some blessings or casting some witch fires at some other units, you know, you only deny those other powers on a six. So are you going to throw out a few and try to stop them on a six? Or are you going to save them and be able to reliably protect your crucial unit? And it's a tough decision.
What I've learned is that the first power that that my opponent cast is not typically the one he's worried about me trying to deny.
I would agree with that.
I think that's what you can almost take that to the bank. You've got to really size up and look for all the poker tells for when that first power is not going to be the feint.
Yeah, I would say that is often the case. The enemy or the player with lots of dice is trying to lure out your deny the witch. So then they can cast the crucial power and you won't have a chance to deny it because you'll be out of dice.
So well, I'm glad you agree with me on that. I think that's something that people could really, if they're struggling with this part of the game, just kind of understand that whatever that first power is it's the dodge, it's the rope-a-dope. Maybe don't fall for it, unless it's like the, you know, Magnus's D power or something. Like if they lead out with what is clearly their overhand right, then wait until at least that second power comes out.
Well, and that's all about prioritizing what you can stop. Right. If you got five dice and they, you know, get something off on three dice, but you only deny on sixes, your odds of stopping that are so low, you're better off saving those five dice on something where they actually have a much better chance of success. Right. So you've got to try to optimize your ability to stop powers by picking and choosing what you can stop.
In that situation, though, what type of powers do you think are the I must throw some dice at this?
Well, you know, if you're a non-psyker army and you only have a handful of dice, then you're just looking to get lucky anyway, right?
I get it, but there's sometimes when you got to fire, you know, fire all the missiles, fire all rounds at this, whatever X power is. What do you think those powers are?
Those powers are typically a power like invisibility or electro displacement, some kind of power that's going to dramatically impact the upcoming turn, especially against the Death Star.
Like a terrify sometimes I find.
Terrify.
You want to stop because that's setting it up for another psychic shriek down the road or something.
Any power that you can tell is going to have a dramatic impact on the game. Then you say, well, I'll get hit by the other powers. This has to stop. Just throw all your dice at it.
Yeah, I would say anything that, well, one, any kind of malediction or something that targets you, you have typically a better shot at denying than anything else. So that puts it into the realm of possibility. Am I better at denying this than I would be something else? I think that makes it a point of consideration.
It does. That's always something to consider.
And then you've got to look at, is this setting me up for a future failure if I let this one go? So that could be something that a debilitating stat, something that makes your opponent harder to hit, or something that, like you're talking about, that transports them all the way across the table into a better position. And these could be like Gate of Infinity, Electro Redisplacement. What's it? Ghost Walk or something?
I can't remember the Chaos name or the Space Marine name, but it's something like that.
That moves a unit. There's Levitate.
Levitate.
You know, that's the kind of stuff that's they're doing that specifically to get you into a worse position later. And so if you can remove that ability from them, then you've made their plans more complicated. You've disrupted the enemy's plans.
And the key to that is really just understanding what your opponent can do with their powers. So, I mean, there are a ton of powers in the game right now. So if you don't know, ask your opponent, hey, what's that do? You make sure they explain it to you, and then you can make those informed decisions.
Yeah, I think that's key. But I just look at that's the decision tree that I think I would take. And maybe you've got your own process, and please share it. But I look at it. It's like, okay, how many dice do they have total? That first power is probably not the one they care about. The second power puts it higher up on the radar, but that also is depending on how many dice they have. If I'm holding five dice in my hand and they have 27, that real power might not come to the third or fourth power.
Yeah, that they can kind of eke it out.
Yeah, and then if I misread the situation, then they just quit casting and I'm still holding my five dice in my hand.
I have been baited that way many a time. It happens.
It's kind of depressing. Like, well, I guess I'll just, maybe I should have rolled my four dice at the power he got three successes on. You never know, right? But I look at this is the decision tree. It's like how many dice they have. If they've got 10 to 14 dice, I'm going to assume that the second or third power is the one that they really want. But sometimes they come out with something that I think that is essentially positioning them for success and me to be disadvantaged. And then I decide, should I stop that? And then I look at their total, like what their total list of powers are, and the ones that I'm most likely to stop, that puts it on my radar too, just to feel like I'm interacting.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you have a decision tree that's similar to that, or if you've got something different or maybe some extra things to add in there.
Well, it's very similar. I think the only thing I would add is that the opposite is also true, right? If you look at the game, regardless of what army you have, and you say all that matters is I cast invisibility right now. That's all that matters. Then just throw all your dice at it. Yeah. Because that's all that matters. Don't get cute with it. Don't try to eke out some dice. Just throw all 10 dice at it and make sure it happens.
I've lost many a psyker trying to get that whatever that one Hail Mary path pass off is. And, you know, perils, of course, because I rolled 19 dice or something.
Well, you know, you always want to avoid that. The plan is always to perils and then roll a six. Well,
sure. But what I'm saying is sometimes it's worth it. Like, I guess I need to eat this psyker so the spawn can charge in invisible and maybe I beat down that unit over there, that their shields are down.
Yeah, sometimes it is worth it, depending on what the power itself does. And not to get too sidetracked on this, but that is one of the incredible advantages that Magnus has, is he can just say, yeah, this power is going to happen. I'm sorry. I'm going to throw 20 dice at it. I'm not going to perils. And, oh, look, it went off 18 times.
That is that's one of the advantages of effective casting dice. Like Magnus's effective casting dice is essentially three times what his pool is.
Yes, because he casts on a two, it's like he's mastery 20 because he becomes so much more effective, you know. So, yes.
That's one of the topics of being the offensive, of being in the driver's seat in the psychic phase. Like how many psychic levels do you need to stock in your army list to be able to cast with whatever the harnessing capability of your army is? And so when you're building out Magnus or Eldar, let's say Magnus, you can assume that you have three times as many dice. Now, your dice pool is still 10, but that equates to you have 30 dice. So the math is scaled off of, in your mind anyway, maybe not your opponent hasn't thought this all the way through, but your mind is you have 30 effective dice worth of casting to do stuff with.
If you compare it to harnessing on a four, then it's like that. Yes.
And I'm simplifying it. I know, of course, but I'm trying to make it, you know, boil it down to something that's kind of easy to digest. And if you're an Eldar with the reroll and harnessing on a three, if you got a Seer Council, then you've got 20% more dice.
Well, for Eldar, it's even more, because since they harness on a three and can reroll, they can reroll just the failed dice. Then their casting is like even more improved. It's closer to a two up, but they can only do it once per phase. But it's closer to a two up when they can harness on a three and reroll just the failed.
I'm with you. So yeah, that's what I wanted to kind of translate is how that really works. And so, because it builds into how many dice you can effectively throw, like, or how many powers you can effectively cast, and maybe also what trees you want to roll on. I mean, it affects many things. Like, if you don't have one of these kind of improvements or maybe enough dice, then you might want to stay away from the trees that have a lot of level two and maybe a level three power in it.
I think you basically have to, like, you know, like for a good example is Kodiaz is everywhere. Everybody likes Kodiaz. But Kodiaz is only level two. So I've seen plenty of lists that Kodiaz is the only psyker in there. So you're looking at having between four and five dice on average most of the time, right? So you've got to think, okay, what can I do with five dice? Well, I have a decent shot at casting two level one powers, right? Or one level two if I throw them all at it. So you got to say, okay, when I'm trying to generate my powers, let's see with that amount of dice on average, what can I make work when I go to roll powers for?
Pyromancy.
Pyromancy's situationally very good. Situationally.
Saying, it doesn't have a ton of those high charge powers in it that can affect it, be effective.
Well, that's a good point. It does have a lot of level ones, and that's a good point.
This has been a good chat on this. I think that, I mean, I feel like I've learned something. You know, it's easy to use past experience of, well, you know, well, I always get invisibility off because I roll four dice. You know, if that's your experience, that's great. But in a pinch, when you really need it, that may not work out.
I mean, and the whole point of the segment here is just so that you can make an informed decision about how to cast psychic powers or what to try to cast. And you can, you know, the calculations themselves, you can go and try to do, or just listen to this again and write them down. But making informed decisions and understanding how the math behind these things work leads to you being able to make more tactical decisions in your games.
Can we run down the odds of casting on a four with the amount of dice that you need to get that 85% again?
Yes, sure. So if you're trying to cast a level one power, then you're looking at three dice. For a level two power, you're looking at six dice. And for a level three power, you're looking at eight dice.
And that's just straight out of the book, caster, needing to harness on a four.
Yes.
I think that's some important information. Horton, I really appreciate you sharing it with us.
Yeah, happy to help. This kind of stuff can be applied to like every part of 40K because it's all dice, and that it's how you make informed decisions, and it can really improve your game.
Yeah, I even like to know when I'm about to rockstar something in. You know, like I want to know, like I really need this to work right now. I appreciate it if it does even more because I know what a long shot it is.
Yeah, it makes the long shots that much more fun when you know the odds of them are 1 in 46,000.
Right. Well, Horde, man, thanks a lot again for talking to me. I hope you have a good rest of your night.
You too.
And the guys, the everybody that's listened to the previous show, you guys have a good rest of y'all's night.
I see dead people.